going to talk today about something that maybe doesn't immediately seem like a spy story. It's a heist.
It's a crazy operation. It's a kind of mix of Ocean's 11 with James Bond.
North Korean covert action is bank robbery.
I'm extremely excited about the idea of becoming a part of your company, and I'm hoping that you will give me an opportunity to present my case in further detail in a personal interview. Here is a link to my resume and cover letter. Thank you in advance for your time and consideration. Welcome to The Rest is Classified. I'm Gordon Carrera. That was the text of what's called a spear phishing email, a targeted email sent to employees of the Central Bank of Bangladesh by cyber operatives of the North Korean government. They were the nose under the tent of the largest cyber heist ever attempted. If successful, it would have been one of the biggest bank robberies in history.
Welcome. I'm David McCloskey. And Gordon, I think we're going to talk today about something that maybe doesn't immediately seem like a spy story. It's a bank robbery. It's a heist performed on the Central Bank of Bangladesh by the North Korean security services. And I think what is so fascinating about this story is that it is a bank robbery, and that's just exciting. But at a deeper level, it's also a story about security services, you know, espionage agencies that effectively operate like the mafia, right? Like an organized crime syndicate. Because underneath all of this and behind that very horribly worded email that I just forced you to read, Gordon, is North Korea's foreign intelligence service out there trying to run a bank robbery, which I think, you know, we tend to think about, and a lot of the spy stories that we talk about in this show are, you know, we think about Moscow rules, we think about the world of John le Carré, we think about spy agencies that are out there trying to collect information. The North Koreans, as we'll see, they kind of don't operate that way.
So it's a kind of mix of Ocean's 11, the heist movie, with James Bond. It's a bit of a blending of the two we're going to try and do with this story.
That's right. And I mean, I think, you know, it's interesting. North Korean, and by the way, inside CIA, the North Korean security services were sort of referred to as NORCs. The NORCs. North Korean security services.
I've never heard that before.
I've only heard... Not North Korean people, but the services, the intelligence agencies.
Right.
We're always called the NORCs. And
so people are working on the NORCs. You're a NORC specialist.
The fundamental thing that North Korea watchers and the guys and girls who target North Koreans at CIA would say is you can't think about these guys like they're a normal intelligence service. You've got to think about them like they're an organized crime syndicate. And really, North Korean covert action is bank robbery, right? I mean, as we'll see, you know, a push for cash for, you know, a family, for the Kim regime that runs North Korea. And I think maybe, Gordon, because the robbers tend to be more interesting than the victims in heist movies, maybe we start there. And so, you know,
yeah, we don't want to turn them into heroes,
no.
But equally, it's not quite like, you know, Brad Pitt and George Clooney in Ocean's 11, these characters, but they are kind of the
right.
more interesting ones. So, yeah.
Exactly.
So the robbers.
And a fundamental piece of this is we actually don't know a lot about the individual robbers that pulled this off, right? Mm. We have a name of one of them, a guy by the name of Park Jin-hook. Who, and by the way, it might not even be his real name because, as you know, he's featured in an FBI affidavit. There's a picture of him sort of scowling out there on the internet, but the North Koreans deny that anyone by that name even exists. And so, you know, he is sort of the shadowy face of the robbery, mm-hmm. right? And he is one of the hackers responsible for the digital side of this heist. Now, a little bit about Park Jin-hook. He's born on August 15th of 1984, although North Koreans, interestingly enough, don't celebrate their own birthdays, only that of the leader. And he's born into a North Korea that's really on kind of the edge of calamity. He's growing up in this kind of totalitarian system that has been run by Kim Il-sung since the 1940s. And, you know, a couple, I think, key points here about the North Korea that Park grows up in. One is he's growing up in the shadow of the Korean War. Okay, even though we're 40 years removed by the time he's, or 30 plus years removed by the time he's born, Park would know this as the Victorious Fatherland Liberation War. And it was a war in which the U.S. dropped more conventional bombs on North Korea than in any Pacific theater, any part of the Pacific theater, rather, that they had in World War II. So it is a place that is sort of utterly devastated during the war, so much so that the U.S. Air Force had complained that it had run out of things to bomb. And it is a place, and I think a critical piece of this is this history of Juche ideology, which is this kind of self-reliance, this idea of really a kind of hermit place that is going to produce everything itself and be totally insulated from the rest of the world.
Closed off from the rest of the world.
Yeah. Exactly. And so by the time Park is a toddler, though, this is starting to change. The Soviet Union, a primary sort of backer of North Korea, is collapsing. And there's succession planning underway. The torch is being passed from Kim Il-sung to Kim Jong-il, his son. That happens when Park is 10 in 1994. And then there's a massive, and of course, most of our listeners are probably aware of this, a massive famine they call the Arduous March that really ravages the country in the mid-90s. And Park, you know, if he's not part of kind of the top upper crust in North Korean society, he probably saw some of this as a child. You know, he would have grown up in a world where there's a huge number of street urchins who are out orphaned by starving parents. Maybe a 500,000 to up to 2 million North Koreans die. And meantime, the Kim family, they're living the high life. Interestingly enough, the Kim family's sushi chef, who's a Japanese cook and actually has come out and made a bunch of comments about this time and said that during the 90s, the Kims ate rice produced in a very special area of the country. They had female workers that actually picked each grain one by one to ensure the size was the same. And actually for 2 years during the famine, Kim Jong-il was the world's largest buyer of Hennessy cognac, and he was importing about $1 million of cognac every year.
So it's a country where people are starving literally on the streets and hundreds of thousands are dying, and the elite is very wealthy. And I think it's also around this time where they're starting to look at nuclear weapons, aren't they, and ballistic missiles, and starting to get more aggressive in their posture towards the West.
Well, that's right. And, you know, all of that, and this will be a critical thread for the, you know, how we end up robbing the Central Bank of Bangladesh, but they need hard currency to support these programs, right? The weapons program, it's not cheap. It's also not cheap to support really kind of an elite structure in North Korea that is critical to keeping the family in power. And I think, you know, this is in essence why we see a spy service become essentially the mob, right? Is because it's all about money. And in fact, there's a, you know, a great kind of tagline about North Korea is that the best way to understand it is as North Korea Incorporated. This guy, John Park, has popularized this idea of it. In an autocratic system, it's all about, you know, money to buy sort of elite support, right? You don't get tossed. You tend to not get tossed by people power. You tend to get tossed by coups, right? Other elites who decide they want to toss you.
So in other words, you need the money to buy off, that you want to buy off.
Exactly.
Yep. And to build your weapons. And and you've got no revenue from exports or anything else that
That's
you
right.
can rely
yeah,
on.
Yeah, precisely. And so, you know, by the time Park is a boy, right, the North Koreans have already started to kind of dip their toes into this world of really crime to support the state, right? There's actually a scheme in the 1980s called super dollars, in which North Korea, of course, you know, Soviet Union collapsing, right? Hard currency needs are high. They say, okay, well, how do we make up for a hard currency shortage? Let's just counterfeit US dollars. And so the North Koreans actually acquire a press from the Italian firm that makes the same press used by the US Treasury.
You can buy
one. They buy one. They go out and buy one.
Seems strange you can buy a printing press to make money, but there you go.
You know, you can. Yeah. So there's an Italian firm that makes them. They went out and bought a press. They acquired $1 bills and then bleached them so they had the right paper. And then they actually got a special color-changing ink for sort of counterfeit prevention, right? So they made the bills and then they tweaked them, of course, to look like American $100 bills, right? And then started to pump these out and would just sell them, you know, at a discount off of the face value out in the black market. Other sources of income, of course, all disreputable: meth, contraband cigarettes, birth control pills, Viagra, which, I don't have any firsthand knowledge of, but they say it's way more potent and has tons more side effects than the actual, you know, pharmaceutical Viagra. So they're out there.
The real stuff.
They are out there, on the black market, just basically engaged in any amount of kind of illicit trade to earn money for the regime.
Right. Do we know how much money they're raising or where it's all going? It just goes to the family, does it? And to the regime to keep them in place.
Well, yeah, I think it goes to military programs. It goes to the family. I mean, it goes into buying off other potential rivals or sort of, you know, elites inside the system. And, you know, this idea, though, of kind of a rigid social structure is also really, really key to our story, because there's a system in North Korea that essentially sorts people into shades of loyalty, right? There's kind of a class system that our bank robber Park is navigating as he comes of age. And really, this class system is kind of, there are actually a number of permutations, dozens and dozens, but there are basically three. You're either loyal, wavering, or hostile. And some defectors call this tomatoes, apples, and grapes. Tomatoes are red, communist to the core. Apples need re-education, and the grapes, of course, are totally hopeless. And so your position is really determined kind of by your family line and by your proximity to, you know, the leader, really. It's called Songbun. And actually, yeah, there's 50 plus categories of this, but they all sort of feed into those three classes above. And critical to Park and his rise is that a way to advance in the system that is apolitical is by being really, really good at math. Really, really good at math. That is a way to improve your Songbun, your position in sort of North Korean society.
So Park, we think, comes from just a normal family, so not part of the elite or anything.
But we don't know. You know, he's probably not in the upper crust, but he's also, mm-hmm. you know, at one sort of key thing that we think about North Korean hackers, and I think we tend to apply, you could apply kind of a Western view of hacking as being this thing that teenagers do in their basements, you know, and then, you know, might go get some education or might start a business, but it's kind of this organic, you know, ground up thing. And that is not how it happens in the North Korean system. This is not a cyber army recruited out of, you know, parents' basements, right? He is probably spotted at a young age for his, you know, proclivity in math. This is during the turmoil of the 1990s. He's probably spotted very young as being in the, you know, sort of upper crust of his cohort in math. And he's sorted into a high school for, you know, gifted children. There would have been highly structured access to the internet in this environment. And he goes, we don't know a lot about his upbringing, but he does go to a very elite school called the Kim Chaek University of Technology. And he graduates from that school in the early 2000s. Now, a word on the school is this is basically a feeder into the military and security services, right?
Is this hacker school? I mean, is this for maths whizzes? If you're a maths whiz, you get plucked out of wherever you are in the education system and put into this fast stream, the kind of equivalent of Oxford and Cambridge, but for hackers, where they think they can make use of you, basically. And that's
right.
The skill set
they right.
want.
And, you know, he, I think in the American context, I mean, this is probably like, you know, he's going to Stanford or MIT, and then because, you know, there isn't a sort of option of I'm going to go work in Silicon Valley or go work for the NSA. It's not sort of how it works in the North Korean context. You know,
he doesn't have any choice. Does he have any
right,
choice
he's,
in this?
He's got really no choice. And I mean, interestingly though, you know, I think we could take a lens on this story in which the North Koreans are a bit cartoonish and kind of incompetent, right? But in reality, his university, Kim Chaek University of Technology, it actually often outperformed American and Chinese, and yes, Gordon, even British, academic institutions in what's called the International Collegiate Programming Contest. And literally in 2019, Park's alma mater placed eighth in this ICPC ahead of Oxford, Cambridge, Harvard, Stanford. So we are talking about a kind of math and technical wizardry that is actually quite good and is competitive internationally. And this is the world that he comes out of. But of course, as we said, he's being directed in sort of this progression, and where does he go? And this is where our kind of hacker tale, as I think we'll both enjoy, becomes much more of a spy story, because he is recruited out of Kimchaek University into the Reconnaissance General Bureau, which is...
And that's the spy service,
North Korea's spy service. And so I think we should set up kind of North Korean spying a little bit here. And it is unclear, we should say, sort of when and how Park joins, but at some point, he is pulled from university into a cyber group that's operating under the RGB. Now, the RGB is a relatively new organization. It's set up kind of out of a reorganization of North Korea's intelligence and security services that happens in the sort of tail end of Kim Jong-il's reign. You scratch under the surface here, and we don't have a lot of hard information, but it's probably the case that this reorg is all part of succession planning as he's trying to pass, you know, sort of the torch over to his son, Kim Jong-un. And the RGB is what I would describe as a very piratical organization, Gordon. This is not MI6 out there, knife and fork set, wining and dining with diplomats and collecting information from cocktail parties, right? It is
right. It's not regular, just collecting information, diplomatic intelligence. It's a bit more aggressive than that.
It is very aggressive, and its resume proves that. I mean, a couple points here. They're responsible, or the sort of predecessor organizations to it, are responsible for kidnapping Japanese citizens and rendering them to North Korea to teach Japanese, blowing up a Korean Air airliner, killing over 100 people in the 80s. They sank a South Korean ship in 2010 with a mini sub, killing 46 sailors. And they also assassinated Kim Jong-un's half-brother in the airport in Kuala Lumpur with a nerve agent, actually convincing two women to smear the agents on his face, killing him.
Now, this is a particularly crazy story, because I remember this one vividly, because, I think there's some CCTV of this happening. And Kim Jong-un's half-brother is in the airport, and one woman walks up to him and sprays something, and another puts a cloth on his face. And I think that it's a binary agent. So the combination of those two things creates VX, which then kills him. And then when they interview the women, they say, thought we were doing a prank for TV. I mean, they were told they're going to get paid $100. And I think that the guy they were doing it to was supposedly in on it. And it was all for some TV show that they had to do this. And in the end, they become kind of assassins in the middle of an airport. I mean, it's a crazy operation, but I guess the point is, it gives you some sense of how far they're willing to go and what they're willing to do if you're the North Koreans. I mean, this is outside of what most normal spy agencies would do, I think.
It is, and it's, I think we could imagine the Russian, some combination of the Russian services doing this. I mean, it's not unheard of course, for the Iranians target, defectors and sort of disloyal elites abroad. Yeah. So killing opponents, political opponents, using a spy service to do that is not unusual. But I would say that the risk tolerance that the RGB seems to have is different from a lot of other spy services, including those that are maybe a bit more rogue or piratical. I mean, literally, one of the subgroups inside the RGB is called the Enemy Collapse Sabotage Bureau, which at CIA, we did not have anything bordering that name. I don't know, Gordon, does MI6 have anything along those lines?
I think if they did, they'd take the signs down when you went round the building. I don't think you'd walk past an office called the Enemy Collapse Sabotage Bureau. Although it does sound a bit like what Special Operations Executive were like in World War II, though, which is basically going around blowing things up and bombing them. I mean, that's the job, yeah?
Yeah, I guess when the RGB would bring in foreign liaison, maybe the Enemy Collapse Sabotage Bureau, the little nameplate outside says, like, you know, Technology Group 204 or something more anodyne. The cyber capabilities, though, that become so critical to this bank heist that we're talking about live inside the 6th Bureau of the RGB, which is their sort of technical bureau. Now, interestingly, there's a whole bunch of different bureaus, Enemy Collapse Sabotage being one of them. This story, though, Gordon, is a story about luck and gambling, too, which is a little tease for folks here, because we're going to spend some time in casinos as this rolls on. There's no 4th Bureau inside the RGB, because 4 is a very unlucky number. And I'll also note that most of the places in Vegas, like hotels, don't have a 4th floor. There's really? Tremendous, because so much of the gaming, both in Asia and in Vegas, is done by Asians who come to game, right? Chinese or otherwise who might come to Vegas to game. The whole environment really caters to these kind of superstitious gambling practices. And 4 is a very, very unlucky number. You will never have a pool in Vegas that is 4 feet deep or that has 4 in the depth. You will not see it, because it's very unlucky. Anyway, right, exactly. Exactly. I think we need to take a rest is classified research trip, Gordon.
Around the pools of Vegas.
That's right. So the number of cyber officers inside the Reconnaissance General Bureau, we don't really know. It's probably somewhere up to 6,000 or 7,000. So it's not small. I mean, it's a large number of people. And again, we know Park. We have a picture of him. But a lot, in fact, most of what we know about these guys, and they're all guys, is through the code that they write. You know, so there's a tendency when you talk about North Korean cyber banditry to kind of, there's a bunch of technical kind of names for these different pockets of the organization that are deploying malware, deploying code as part of these attacks. And they all have different names, you know, Lazarus Group, Hidden Cobra, Beagle Boys, you know, that kind of makes, again, it has this weird tendency of making it all kind of sound like a bunch of tech, you know, nerds, right?
Yeah, it's a weird thing with cyber, because the cybersecurity research community comes up with its own name. So there's no official names, but some of them have very dull names like APT-28, and then they have kind of silly names like Fancy Bear for some of the Russians, and some of the Chinese ones are called, I think, Pandas and other things. And these are all just kind of slightly comical names given to the groups. But yeah, some of the North Koreans, I think, Lazarus Group is perhaps the most famous for the North Koreans.
And all these names are, of course, given by Western kind of cybersecurity watchers, right, who name the code effectively. So Park, and I think this is a key point, is because he's coming from this, or in this organization that is extremely aggressive, it's extremely brutal. It is predominantly, if not entirely, male. And the people who look at the code say it's simple, it's practical, and it's brutal. So Park is in this organization. Now, he's working in Pyongyang, but at some point, there's some digital dust where we start to learn a little bit about him. And it is because in 2011, he's sent to China to work as a developer for something called Chosun Expo, which is basically a front organization for the RGB.
Now, isn't this interesting that the North Koreans have an outpost or a front in China from which they do some of their hacking? Should we be surprised at that? That the Chinese allow that or tolerate it? Or what does that tell us?
Yeah, well, I mean, it is practical. You think, you know, broader access to the internet, of course. You don't have to use North Korean IP addresses, you know, from China.
So you can mask where you're coming from.
A little bit. And it's kind of an outpost, I think, is the right way to think about it, because a lot of what Park is doing in this period, he also gets married, by the way. Lucky guy, he gets married in September after he goes to China. He refers to his fiance as comrade in the written communications, and actually does go back to North Korea for the wedding. But really what he's doing, again, it's the beginnings of what will become the heist, but he's just making money. You know, he's making online games and writing the code for them and then selling them.
So,
you know?
Yeah.
He's a developer.
So he's a developer.
Yeah,
he's a software developer.
And, you know, you think from the North Korean standpoint, here's a guy who's probably one of their most promising cyber recruits. He's come out of this elite organization or elite university, and he's working for the RGB. This is a bit of like his first kind of field expedition, you know, in some ways. It's a field posting to do what the RGB is really intended to do, which is to make money for the Kim family and for the regime. So he's selling games. Now, interestingly, they're working out of this place called the Chilbosan Hotel, which is named after a famous mountain range in North Korea. The TVs in the restaurant and bar have videos of the Korean War up in which the North wins. And he's really, you know, there's political minders there. So we shouldn't think of this as some, you know, exercise in freedom, right?
Holiday.
Yeah. There are RGB minders who are there making sure that everything is in order. And he stays there for a couple of years.
He's out there learning his skills, basically. But he's not yet the kind of cyber operative hacking into Western businesses and companies, we think.
No, that's exactly right. I mean, he's probably operating on a quota system of he's got a certain amount of cash that he needs to earn every year. The bulk of it's going to go back to the government in North Korea. And he does this for a couple of years, really probably to learn how the internet works, you know, to really understand the sort of digital kind of to do reconnaissance in effect on the open internet, which is not something he would have done even in his university days in North Korea.
Because we should be clear that in North Korea, access to the internet is really limited. I think there's 1% of people have access to it. So, and what access there is very tightly controlled. We're in Pyongyang, which I guess maybe contrary to what people might expect, is a bit of a boom town in a strange way.
Yeah, that's, you know, I think, Gordon, my mental model of Pyongyang was massive military parades, you know, very organized, sort of choreographed, kind of big stadiums full of people weeping for the dear leader, or frankly, a famine ravaged place. And I think the reality of Pyongyang and the Pyongyang that Park comes back to after his time in China is that Kim Jong-un, of course, Rocket Man, you know, as Trump famously called him, is now the North Korean leader. And Pyongyang is undergoing massive changes, which I think, you know, Park, he's kind of this shadowy figure here because we don't know a lot about him. Mm. But I have to think that he's not unaffected by the change in leadership and frankly, by the fact that Pyongyang is now, as you said, a boomtown. I mean, you know, Kim, in his first speech, marking his grandfather's 100th birthday, says North Koreans will never have to tighten their belts again. And there is a massive loosening going on in Pyongyang in this era of restrictions on private enterprise. There's a massive increase in the number of government-approved markets. The annual sort of, you know, economic output of North Korea has doubled under Kim Jong-un. The population, of course, is still, I think you could say, undernourished, but it is not a famine, right? People are not dying from hunger. The economy is growing, as you teased before the break. There's a tremendous amount of recreational meth usage in North Korea.
And really?
Kim Jong-un's nickname is Nanugi, the person who shares. Lots of people are making money under him. It's also going to him. Most of it is going upward. But, you know, the individual is actually given opportunities to make some cash in the Kim economy.
If you're a person on the make, if you're this young programmer, Park, you're seeing a bit of that boomtown life, and you think you've got a shot at being part of it, effectively, by having been selected as a hacker. I mean, you've got a road into perhaps wealth, or maybe not, if not the top elite, but, you know, into this world.
I think so. I mean, you know, a little bit of speculation here on Park's psychology, I think, would be warranted, because you got to think this is a guy who has probably improved his family standing significantly by working for the RGB. He's gone to one of the best schools in the country, right? So he is a sort of upwardly mobile member of the elite. He's spent time abroad. Very few North Koreans do that, even if it's just across the border in China. And he is in this, you know, sort of, you know, gold rush kind of Pyongyang, where it's not just working for, you know, an extra ration of rice or anything like that. I mean, he has the opportunity for some real, you know, conspicuous consumption. I mean, this is, I think, you know, listeners to this should understand that the Pyongyang of this era, I mean, there are ski resorts with Austrian chairlifts and Italian skis. There's Italian restaurants, there's sushi bars, there's places that have craft beer, there's rollerblading rinks by the river. People are wearing clothes, H&M, Zara, like, you know, brands that we would recognize in the West. And a lot of this is kind of show stuff. I mean, these restaurants are not always full. You know, you kind of have to scratch your head at a place where a cab ride would actually be a few months of government salary. I mean, it's a sort of bizarre system, but, you know, there is money and there is outside influence here in a way that was not true 20 years before. And I have to think Park is looking at this and saying, how do I get more of it? You know, I mean, there more than 10% of North Koreans have cell phones now, and, you know, pet dogs, there's status symbols that would have been absolutely unthinkable, you know, a generation earlier. And I got to think that Park thinks, I want to get me some of that, you know? I mean, that's got to play a role in his psychology here.
But this is a country which is not exporting much, and yet it seems to be importing all these luxury goods and other things you've been talking about, and it needs money. So where is the money coming from? That's the obvious question. What's supporting the North Korean economy?
That's right. Well, and it's crime in many respects, you know. How is it being paid for? Well, you know, the North Koreans call this the secret war. And this is what Park is going to become, a kind of, you know, an elite soldier in the midst of. So there is, to pay for all of this, a massive uptick in cybercrime in the first kind of decade of Kim's rule. Now, some estimates actually have the hacking at about maybe responsible for a third of North Korea's GDP. So it is a massive...
A third. I mean, that's an astonishing figure.
It's an astonishing figure, right? It's insane. Yeah.
So a third of the country's income is coming from international crime.
Exactly. So this is, you know, in some respects, Park is part of one of the biggest businesses, you know, in North Korea. Mm. And I want to return for a second to sort of put the scale of the consumption, you know, in context, because we're of course talking about a Pyongyang where, I mean, that money is going to support, you know, a 2 or 3 bedroom apartment in Pyongyang is like $80,000. The official government salary is $4 per month. So again, how do you bridge that gap? Kim, the leader, he's got 33 homes, 28 are linked to private railway stations. His main compound covers 5 square miles. He renovated recently, Gordon, you'll be happy to know. The price tag of the renovations was a cool $175 million, although of course it's hard to verify that. So the money is to do this is coming from this crime. Now, some of these attacks, of course, are political in nature, right? The RGB is attempting to gain an advantage over its adversaries. So it's trying to get, you know, IP from Western aerospace and defense firms, things like that, right? They're sort of
stealing commercial secrets,
something that, you know, quote unquote, normal espionage agencies do the world over, right? But a lot of the crime is just pure cash, right? They go after cryptocurrency exchanges. There's been multiple billions of dollars raised from those kind of attacks over the past 6 or 7 years. There's ransomware attacks against healthcare organizations. Very famously, there was the attack against Sony Pictures, right? Entertainment, if you remember this one, where Sony was releasing that film, The Interview, which ends with a sort of, I don't think he's actually named Kim Jong-un, but it's obviously Kim Jong-un, and he's explodes in a fireball set to Katy Perry music.
And they got really upset about that, didn't they? Because the idea of a film making, a comedy film making fun of the of their leader and him being assassinated by, I think, visiting journalists, caused them enough upset to hack Sony Pictures and steal and release their emails.
And threaten 9/11 style attacks on theaters that showed the film for good measure.
You don't have any concerns then about us doing a podcast on North Korea?
But... yeah, that's actually, you're saying it too late, Gordon. We're too deep.
We're too deep. If our stable mates get hacked and their emails,
we should hope for the notoriety to land on Kim Jong-un's radar. I think that would be, I would welcome yeah, such reach. I mean, that
be careful what you wish for.
Well, I mean, frankly, that Sony Pictures attack, you know, is obviously very political in nature. There's like a whole separate story there, right? That could frankly be its own.
Yeah.
You know, they of course are attacking, you know, going after academics and other institutions to kind of solicit opinions on North Korea and North Korean policy in the West and make it look like they're not, you know, it's not actually coming from North Korea. It's going after defectors, of course, and critically, Gordon, banks, right? They are going after banks from Vietnam to Mexico to Taiwan and Bangladesh.
That's where the money is, in the banks. And it's interesting, isn't it, that cybercrime offers a new world for North Korea. You know, we were talking about printing presses before and counterfeit money. I mean, that's a old-fashioned way of doing it. Now online, they've suddenly realized they've got this opportunity to reach into organizations and institutions around the world and try and either hold them into ransom or, in the case of banks, actually steal their money and get inside it. And that seems to be their modus operandi with this one particular hack, which we're going to look at. But it's more than a hack, isn't it? It's a heist. It's a proper full-on heist in 2015, where they're looking at trying to get a massive sum of money from a bank. I mean, it is extraordinary how ambitious this is, and targeting Bangladesh of all places. Maybe
that's
precisely
right,
because it's not the most obvious place to go for with the highest security, I guess.
Well, and I think what the sort of their efforts to send, you know, these horribly written spear phishing emails, like the one you so graciously
read. Yeah, that
was
the one I started with. Yeah, that's how it starts, isn't it?
They are not being picky about where they're sending those, right? I mean, they're sending those out to figure out, well, where can we get in, right? And between, you know, sort of the year before the Bangladesh heist really starts to unfold, there's 9 bank compromises all over the world that are linked back to North Korea. Now, not on the scale and unsuccessful ultimately at taking money out, but the North Koreans are not, this isn't someone's, you know, sort of sitting in Pyongyang thinking it would be great to, you know, take Bangladesh down a notch. I mean, this is very, they're trying everywhere. Exactly.
Yeah. But what I find fascinating is it's a long running operation. I mean, this isn't just a quick, we're going to hack into it. And like you see in the movies where someone hacks into something and then, you know, presses a few buttons and withdraws millions of dollars. This is something which is very, very well crafted, in which they start out with that job seeker email that I read from right at the start, where they're using that to get into the Bangladesh systems of a bank, getting someone to click on the link to think that this is a resume from someone who wants a job, and then using that access to effectively get inside the system and then understand the system. And that's a process which they spend months over, don't they? I mean, this is not quick. They are really researching and trying to understand how the bank system works and get access to the machines, get access to the networks, and then look for how they can find a plan to basically steal a very large amount.
Exactly. And I think here, you know, so much of this story could just be one where we have a mental model of, okay, it's a bunch of hackers kind of sitting in, you know, a room somewhere running this thing. But keep in mind, this is going on, and we don't have any, you know, sort of firsthand information on this, but this is an operation going on and being run by the RGB. So there is an operational chief to this. This is an espionage operation at the end of the day. And, you know, Park and his team, they're probably sitting in some kind of brutalist building or compound owned by the RGB. Probably doesn't have those hacker hostile vibes. It probably feels a little bit more like a barracks. And they are running reconnaissance on the Central Bank of Bangladesh network. Now, it's not a smash and grab job, as you mentioned. And I think we don't want to be overly technical, Gordon, but I think, you know, we can, I'm gonna talk dirty here in code for a second to give you some sense of what the North Koreans are up to. They're using a piece of malware called NestEgg, which gives them sort of persistent access to these infected machines. So you picture someone literally in Central Bank of Bangladesh HR has clicked on the link that Rasul Alam so graciously put into his email advertising his services. So they're getting access to these machines, right? They're using something called Sierra Charlie to then hop from infected machines to more interesting parts of the bank, because they're not ultimately interested in the HR, you know, administrator's computer. They want to know, they want to get kind of into more sensitive pieces of the bank that are actually responsible for transactions. And then they use something called MacTruck to make that hopping encrypted, and critically, to make it invisible to the bank's IT staff. So literally over a reconnaissance operation that takes almost a year between 2015 and early 2016, they are moving around in the bank, sort of wiping the malware from the previous machines, covering their tracks, and trying to get closer and closer to a system that is very technical, but that will enable them to move funds in and out of the bank.
And I guess the point is, it is a bit like a heist movie where the effort is really in the reconnaissance, isn't it? Is in coming up with a plan, working out a way of hiding your tracks and being able to get out with the money. It is very similar to that rather than just the break-in. It's no good just kind of breaking in and people seeing what you're doing. And the key is that they're going for something called SWIFT, which is the mechanism used for banks to move money between themselves, isn't it, internationally. And that's the key that they realize to be able to get hold of serious money for this heist.
Yes, SWIFT, the Society for Worldwide Interbank Financial Telecommunications, which is as dry as it sounds. But the North Koreans, and again, you know, I like to think of Park and the software, the coders, sitting in a room eating the North Korean equivalent of Pop-Tarts, maybe. And then you've got, you know, an operational chief who is starting to think and probably conceptualizing an operation in which he says, once we get into this SWIFT system, how do we think about actually bringing money, bringing actual dollars into North Korea? And what they come up with, and, you know, they've been in the Central Bank of Bangladesh's computers for almost a year by the time we get access to the SWIFT system. So they're very patient. They are looking basically to be able to craft and authenticate and then send SWIFT messages that look totally legit, that originate from Bangladesh Bank's computer system, and then to be able to destroy those digital messages so no one else inside the bank would know anything is wrong. And what they end up doing once they get access to SWIFT is it's very, again, this code being sort of simple and brutal. They're able to accomplish all this by getting into the SWIFT system source code and then just deleting a few characters. So it's a year of work. I mean, like, I think in all good espionage operations, the sort of the gap that you're looking toward is, you know, very small, but you've had to do a tremendous amount of legwork to kind of get to that point. And so on Thursday, the 4th of February, 2016, that groundwork is laid. Park and his RGB comrades are in the SWIFT system at the Central Bank of Bangladesh, and they are about to initiate one of the largest bank robberies in history.
Well, David, that seems like a good place to leave it there, with the RGB and Park, at least in cyber terms, walking into the vault with all those gold bars and all that bullion in front of them. And when we come back next time, we'll see how they get away with carrying out the loot. See you next time.
Goodbye.